Welcome to Encounter, abc.net.au/rn. I'm Kerry Stewart, and this week we're going to a secret location to reveal the connection between religion and comic books.
99 stones of light and power scattered around the world. 99 powers beyond imagination. Ninety-nine young heroes, their fate not yet revealed, but their struggle against evil stretches back through the ages.
That's a preview of a new TV animation series which is based on a comic book. The 99 is not only a popular comic in the Middle East, it's recently been translated into 8 languages for a global audience. Today we'll ask the Kuwaiti creator of the 99 why he thinks it's important to expose the world to his superheroes, each one being endowed with one of the 99 attributes of Allah. We'll also explore the way comics in India are regarded by some Hindus as sacred texts that can lead to divine revelation. We'll find out why Torah portions that are read each week in synagogues around the world now have a humorous comic to accompany them. And talk to a Christian theologian who thinks Superman and Jesus have a lot in common.
As someone who faces the grueling every Sunday deadline of preaching, I guess I learned a long time ago to keep my antenna up for anything that might offer a fresh way to express very old ideas and very old truths. And I find a great deal of religious significance in comic books and in the characters that inhabit those gaudy four-color pages.
Comic books can tell us quite a bit about the heroes that are important to a culture, as well as the villains and the mythologies that cultures tell. What's important, what's heroic, some of those big questions in life that we all struggle with.
You know, the West has for years mined biblical archetypes to inform its storytelling, whether it's, you know, Hollywood blockbusters and things like superheroes that are based on archetypes but are not religious in any way. But have found global ideas that are worth spreading. The Quran hasn't been mined for that, and so I took it upon myself to use the Quran as the source for the archetypes for my storytelling.
We, as Jews, are actually commanded to do this kind of work.
I think it's the 613th commandment is that we should write our own Torah. So, I mean, this is we took that quite literally in our writing our own Torah.
Yeah, we think that they meant you're supposed to write out the official version yourself.
I think that what they meant is you're supposed to pay a scribe to do it, actually.
Well, but, is that?
But we're doing it our own way. But we're also participating in an ancient practice of midrash, which is Torah interpretation, or bringing the stories into your own life and into your own time, and also just finding meaning, pulling the meaning out of the story for yourself.
In the recent past, there was a Christian bias against many aspects of pop culture, comic books, movies, television included. And I believe that has shifted some in recent years. Not entirely. There are still conservative groups who are skeptical of those things. But I think more and more Christians are recognizing that God can speak through a variety of media. After all, the whole notion of Jesus coming into the world to meet us where we are suggests that God is still reaching out to us where we are, and most of us live smack dab in the middle of a world permeated with radio programming and music and television and books and, yes, comic books.
I'm drawing a cartoon representation of Jesus. It's great for radio, of course, because you can't see, but it's a brilliant picture. It's not as cheesy as some of the Disney-style things, perhaps a bit more influenced by Australian comic and cartoon artists. This one I'm working on is animated cartoon Bible stories. So it's as much as possible just straight Bible text without too much translation, just telling the story as it is in a way that's going to be engaging for kids. Hi, I'm Phil Watson. I'm a Christian cartoonist. And I really love, obviously, I love the Bible stories. I love the way that, you know, obviously Jesus only, pretty much only taught in stories. I think kids are the greatest audience as well. I tell a few stories at schools and they just love it. To tell a story with pictures, particularly funny pictures, is just very listenable for kids. Putting a bit of fun into it, I think fun is a God-given thing, so let's use it particularly to get this story across.
Using images to get a Christian story across isn't new. Visual storytelling in the form of stained glass windows, paintings and carvings in the doors of cathedrals has a long Christian history and has been described as the poor man's Bible. Reverend Michael Brewer is a pastoral theologian, teaches religion at Northern Kentucky University, and is a longtime fan of comic books.
In the Middle Ages, a lot of people were illiterate, and even those who could read were often not conversant with Latin. And so those pictures became a way of telling the story that was accessible to large numbers of people. It seems to me that in today's world, given the general decline in biblical literacy, that there is a more pressing need than ever before for Christians and people of various faiths to bring their story in ways that seem non-traditional. Although I will say that, in fact, the notion of using the culture has always been embedded in Christianity. The early church fathers debated whether it was all right to use worldly art forms and worldly music as ways to express Christian faith, and they decided that it was. They called it pillaging the gold of the Egyptians. Going back to the story in Exodus, when the children of Israel depart from Egypt, released from their slavery, and on their way, the Egyptians are so eager to hurry them out the door and end these plagues that they shower gifts of gold and silver on the Israelites. So the notion in the early church fathers was that the Israelites left behind the paganism and the false gods of Egypt, but they took some of the gold with them. And I think modern Christians are seeing that with any medium, comic books included, there are probably some pieces and aspects that are worth ignoring and discarding, but there are also some nuggets of gold there that we would be foolish not to take advantage of.
How do you draw Jesus?
While I'm drawing?
Yeah, okay. That'd be good.
It's always a tricky one, like Christians and I guess Muslims and Jews as well, are they very aware of, you know, God saying, don't make an image of me, don't bow down to it. But when you think about it, that's for a Christian, God made an image of himself in Jesus. And obviously he was the Son of God, and well, for a Christian to say that, like myself. So when I'm coming to draw Jesus, I'm aware of that sort of stuff. Definitely I try to give him a nice big nose. Well, I guess it's almost a reaction to the cheesy kind of stuff that I've seen when I was younger. And the reality was, he's a carpenter, he's a Jew, spent a lot of time in the sun, so he wasn't a white guy with the centre part and all that sort of stuff. So I try and make him look at least a little bit Middle Eastern, because he was. And then pretty much the rest of it is just trying to make him... he was very approachable. Kids felt they could approach him. They were the ones who felt most comfortable with him. So there was something about him that was approachable.
And has he got muscles, like in the Ten Commandments, the movie?
He's got carpenter muscles. So obviously this is a bit more kind of cartoony, so I'm not showing his muscles. But he's not going to be flexing when he's up there on the cross. He's going to be hurting. So I guess I'm trying to, as much as possible, paint a picture of Jesus as much as the Gospels tell us. And it actually says in Isaiah, the prophecy about him, that he was like someone that we turn our face away from. So I'm trying not to make him too pretty to be accurate to the prophecies about him. At the same time, not freaking kids out going, this guy is either, he's someone I can't relate to, or he's some sort of muscle-bound superhero that I can't picture being a humble kind of guy.
Synagogues and mosques aren't adorned with pictorial stories from their sacred books, like cathedrals are. But for Jews, interpretation of the Torah isn't new.
I'm Sharon Rosenzweig.
And I'm Aaron Freeman. and we are the co-creators of the Comic Torah. The Comic Torah has lived most of its life as a two-page online reimagining of the weekly Parsha HaShavua, which is the portion of the Hebrew Bible that is the first five books of Moses that Jews read every week, so that at the end of every year we've read through the entire five books of Moses.
Now, Aaron, you've been described as Midwestern North America's foremost Torah maven. What is a maven, and why isn't it an important job?
I'm a Torgerman. Torah maven is how I explain it to people who've never heard of it before. The basic idea is that many years ago, when the Hebrews were taken out of Palestine, brought by Nebuchadnezzar and taken to Babylon, very shortly, within a couple of decades, they forgot how to speak Hebrew. They stopped speaking Hebrew because they were in Babylon and all the cool people spoke Aramaic. But the ancient writings were still in the biblical Hebrew, and the old stories were still told in the Hebrew, because that was how it was very important that they were told that way. So there emerged a profession of the mitergamen, which is the Aramaic word for translator. And the mitergamen's job was to translate the biblical Hebrew into vernacular Aramaic, entertaining vernacular Aramaic, because you got to keep it lively here, you know, keep the attention of the crowd. And so that was how Judaism was done for the first 1,500 years of its existence. About 1,000 years ago, the mitergamen as a profession died out, and I'm a part of a movement to bring back the profession of the mitergamen. And I am the mitergamen for Eitz Chaim congregation in my home of Highland Park, Illinois. And we are the first congregation to have a resident mitergamen in 1,000 years of Jewish history.
And how do the people, the congregation, receive you as a translator of the Torah?
They are, I think I can safely say, highly entertained, which is the entire point. And really, that's the point of the mitergamen, and that's the point of the Comic Torah. We like to say that Judaism will die of boredom long before it dies of heresy.
So this is a matter of literacy.
Well, when you're asking about literacy in terms of the Hebrew, I think that it's not just a matter of that American Jews don't have Hebrew. They don't read the Torah in English either. So we have friends that say to us, like, wow, I've never read the whole book cover to cover like this before. We sometimes tell them, well, you still haven't. And then other times people say, like, oh, you must be making this up. This can't really be in the Torah. And we'll sit them down and show them where it is. And they'll take the real book and read it and be like, oh, this is actually in here. I can't believe it. So people are sort of seduced by the ease of the Comic Torah into reading the actual thing.
So what have been the motivations of some of the other comic book creators around the world? Let's go to India, where Amachitrakatha comics have been telling Hindu mythological stories since 1967. Dr. Carlene McLean spent time there researching her book, India's Immortal Comic Books.
The creator of Amachitrakatha, which means immortal picture stories, his name is Anant Pai. And one day in 1967, he was in New Delhi, the capital city, and he was watching a quiz contest on TV, and the students were all students in an elite college in Delhi. And the questions that they were asked in this quiz contest were about Greek mythology. And they could answer all of the questions. They were excellent. And then a series of questions was posed about Hindu mythology, and none of these Indian college students could answer the questions. And so he was disillusioned. He returned back home, which for him was Mumbai. And there he saw his own nephews and nieces reading through Western comic books. And he sort of had an aha moment and realized at that point in time that one way to teach children their own mythology in India would be to create an Indian comic book series.
But this was a recent problem, wasn't it? Because previously generations had been able to read the language of the sacred texts, which is Sanskrit, and now these children couldn't.
Yeah, it had been traditional for at least a number of children in India, you know, generation after generation, to learn Sanskrit, to memorize sacred scripture, to pass it on from one generation to the next orally. But of course, throughout the 20th century, as you had more and more people leaving the traditional context behind, moving into the cities, the joint family system breaking down, nuclear families being set up, some of that tradition was starting to fall by the wayside.
When the comics were first produced, this was a new generation of Indians, wasn't it? It was after partition and after British rule. It was 1967. So people were trying to identify themselves.
Absolutely, yeah. The period when he started making the very first issue in this series, Krishna, in 1967, this is just 20 years after the independence of India, the partition of India and Pakistan, after the end of colonial rule. And so this was a time period of really rapid change in India. India worked to modernize as India was really working to make sure that there were resources available to support its whole population, that children were being educated. National integration was a key phrase that you heard quite a bit throughout the 1970s and 80s as these comic books were being released into the marketplace, that they depicted an integrated nation, one that was a model of unity in diversity, that had a number of representatives, Hindus and Muslims and others, who were part of the nation. And so eventually Anand Pai decided to create comic books to try to feature these different groups, to pull them together into this idea of nationhood. And he created one issue on Jesus Christ and included a number of the Sikh gurus, for instance. There's an issue on the Buddha. So he featured a range of different religious figures in order to try and improve national integration.
And now to Kuwait. Dr. Naif Al-Matawa is a clinical psychologist and the creator of the 99. The 99 superheroes are young people scattered around the world, each one having found a gemstone that embodies an attribute of Allah, endowing them with a special power.
So what I did is I went back to the Quran. I went back to this very same place that other people have managed to, you know, squint their eyes and look backwards and pull out hateful messages and gone back and pull out some positive pluralistic messages. And so the 99 refer to the 99 attributes of Allah in the Quran, things like generosity and mercy and foresight and dozens of others that until we started doing our work weren't used to describe Islam in the media, neither in the Islamic world nor outside the Islamic world. So the idea was for this to be an aspirational storyline. You know, growing up, I always heard about where Islam was and how it was, you know, big in the past. But no one talked about the future. And so this is kind of, you know, positioning stuff for kids to want to aspire to compete with the hateful messages out there.
Now, you've lived in America. So how did 9/11 and the political and social impact of that event influence you and the creation of the comic?
The events of 9/11 influenced me tremendously. I'm the father of five boys who were born in New York, all of whom are U.S. citizens as well as being Kuwaiti citizens. And how they're going to be perceived and how they themselves perceive Islam after 9/11 was, you know, weighed on my mind a lot. I've heard a million theories about, you know, what really happened 9/11, but the one thing that is scary for me is that whoever or whatever was behind 9/11 was taking down Islam in the way I understood it and the way I wanted to mean for my own children. And typically when things go that crazy in the West, you say, sounds like a job for Superman, right? But there was no Superman. And so part of the initiative for that grew out of 9/11. It grew out of my years working at Bellevue Hospital and the Survivors of Political Torture Program, you know, where I worked with people who were tortured for their religion, their background. I worked with Arabic-speaking patients, but there are people there from all over the world. We don't have a monopoly on how not to treat others. So it's a combination of these factors that kind of led to the 99.
Do you see parallels between yourself as the creator of the 99 and the creators of Superman?
I see a parallel between my creation of the 99 and the creation of Superman and Batman in the sense that Superman and Batman were created by Jewish men during the height of anti-Semitism. And the 99 was created by a Muslim man during the height of Islamophobia. So in that sense, yes, I see a connection between the two, that they both came out of social misgivings about the place of self and other and wanting to do something about that.
So what are the religious implications of Superman's story? Christian theologian and author of Who Needs a Superhero, Dr. Michael Brewer.
The religious implications of this are difficult to miss. You have a figure in the sky sending a son to Earth with the notion that this son will both belong to human culture and be a human being in some sense, but will also stand apart from that culture and will be more than a human being. Kal-El grows up to be Clark Kent, human, accepted as human, but with this other side that allows him to interact in the world and to do good and to be a saving figure, a rescuing figure, and to make a difference in the world. Part of the irony behind this is that the teenagers that dreamed this up, Joe Shuster and Jerry Siegel, were in fact Jewish. They were the children of first-generation immigrants from Europe. And so they clearly were not attempting to create an explicitly Christian reading with the creation of Superman. But at the same time, aware of what was going on in Europe with the rise of Nazism and the persecution of Jews, they clearly did see Superman as a person who could marshal strength and power in order to right wrongs and in order to protect the weak and to save those who could not save themselves. So Superman becomes a kind of messianic figure within that Jewish framework. The interesting thing about Superman is, and I think this is the stroke of genius of Siegel and Shuster, with his power, he could rule the world. It would take about 5 minutes for Superman to disarm all the nuclear weapons in the world and to force every earthly government to kowtow to his wishes. He chooses not to do that because although Superman is not beyond using power, he also believes that power must be used to protect and lift up and to build, never to destroy. And so you have this character who could rule the world and yet chooses to be a servant. It certainly resonates with the story of Jesus' temptation in the wilderness in the early chapters of Matthew, in which Satan comes to Jesus and tempts him to make demonstrations of power that would allow him to be a king and rule the world. And Jesus flatly and repeatedly rejects those overtures and instead embraces a ministry of lowliness and humility and service and self-sacrifice, very much like Superman.
Christians in North America have a long history of making comics that tell Bible stories and explore their faith. Comics 35 is a non-profit organization that teaches Christians around the world how to produce comics for the purpose of evangelism. They're the consultants for the very popular Manga Messiah series, which comes out of Japan. And another project, called the 1040 Window, is focused on teaching skills to people living between 10 and 40 degrees north of the equator. Nate Butler is a veteran cartoonist and president of Comics 35.
The 1040 Window is an area of the world where it's about home to about 3 billion plus people, 37 of the world's 50 least evangelized countries, the majority, about over 2.5 billion of the world's Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists. And this is an area of the world where literally billions of people are reading billions of comics every year, and yet they don't have significant access to scriptural truth in this literature form that they read most. So we've been doing a lot of work in this window, including China.
And there's a competition running at the moment in Africa, isn't there?
Yes. Another one of the interesting things that it seems like everywhere the French set their feet in this world, they left behind a love of comics. So we're working right now on a project. We're inviting Christian cartoonists from all the Francophone countries of Africa to submit comics that we're going to publish in a single volume.
And in this 1040 window that you're talking about, people of other religions, do they object to Christian comics coming in?
What our ministry always does is work with local people to produce their own comics for their own people in their own languages. We don't import comics into these countries from outside. Now, having said that, that still doesn't reduce the objection level of some people. Yet, on the other hand, this isn't all happening in a vacuum. The Muslims and Hindus are also acutely aware of the impact of comics in their culture and are also producing their own comics. Hindu comics are quite common in India and in Saudi Arabia. They're actually producing a comic. It's called Q Kids. It's mostly an adventure-style comic. But it's interestingly, it's in English, and in the middle of the comic, it contains a section telling children how to become good Muslims. And they're produced also in that Japanese manga styles. And as I tell people, what does that tell you? I mean, these are not for their own children. These are also a recruiting tool. So again, Muslims and Hindus are doing the same thing as we're doing. They have eyes and ears just like us, and they see what's going on, and they're trying to use the medium as well.
So another story I've been, I might touch up this animation for Christmas, is just the story of Jesus coming to Earth, and I guess the surprise of the shepherds. Shepherds are always good ones to draw because they've got the lovely tea towel on their head. So maybe here's some shepherds running to see Jesus, the Son of God, born as a baby. So that's always a good bit of action here as well. So yes, here we got the baby Jesus lying in the manger. And as we know from all of the hymns, that baby was just so lovely and didn't cry and never had a dirty nappy and stuff. I'm using irony there just in case you hadn't guessed. I've had babies myself, and I know that sometimes they just cry for no reason. So here's Jesus in the smelly, if only we had smell-o-vision here, that's the hay sounds you can hear there. And there he is in the very dirty, very smelly, that stink lines. Can you hear the stink lines going on there? That stink lines from the stable. I do like the Aussie angle on things, and I think it really resonates with the Jesus of the Bible. I have copped a bit of flack over the years for, I guess, from maybe religious people for making it seem too, I don't know, down to earth or whatever. But I can't help seeing that's what Jesus did. He took this sort of the message of God and brought it to the people where they were at. And that's the beauty. That's why I'm a Christian, because, I think Jesus wasn't afraid to create controversy, not only with amongst the religious people of the day, but also amongst his friends. So there's that Aussie element, the Aussie larrikin, or I don't know what it is. It's a bit cheeky, a bit irreligious, which I think is just perfect for the Aussies do well, and that Jesus did well.
Christian cartoonist Phil Watson. Australians aren't the only ones who are playfully irreverent when interpreting sacred scriptures for comics. The Comic Torah is not only a comic book about the Torah, it's also funny. Stand-up comedian Aaron Freeman and artist Sharon Rosenzweig are the co-creators.
We try to be irreverent, but it turns out that when we do our homework, we really fail. That we are not nearly as outrageous and as weird as the real serious rabbis who've done interpretations and translations. We thought that we were really radical. For example, if anyone who reads the Comic Torah will notice that our version of the Hebrew God is female, which we thought was just really out there. But it turned out when we did our homework.
Oh, well, that there's a long tradition that the feminine aspect of God, which is known as the Shekhinah, was the aspect that accompanied the Hebrews in the wilderness and occupied the Mishkan, which is this sort of traveling temple that they built. It was a big art project that they made while they were in the wilderness.
And also she's green.
Yes, she is green.
That was the
other thing. It's not easy being green.
I got to admit that I'm not aware of any precedent in the Torah for a green god, I got to say. So that was a bit of our own artistic license. We didn't want to play race at all. So green took us completely out of the whole racial thing and put us more into the realm of space aliens, with which we are a bit more comfortable. There are some people who honorably believe that unless one brings a certain amount of reverence to the book and to the study, there's really no point to it. And they see irreverence as kind of diminishing the value of the whole endeavor. We just don't agree. We very much don't agree. There's no question, though, that we have offended. We make presentations of the Comic Torah. We show slides of it, and we talk about it at various Jewish groups, particularly at Limud gatherings around the world. And we have certainly found people who were offended. And we simply say that no one, no artist can please everybody. But even more importantly, our great dream in life is that people will see the Comic Torah and go, "That's not how you ought to do it." And then they'll go and make their own. And we want to see theirs.
Translation and interpretation can be controversial. So did Anant Pai, the creator of the first Hindu comic in India, Amachitra Katha, translate the stories literally from the Hindu sacred texts, which are in Sanskrit? Or were the stories changed to suit the times? Dr. Carlene McLean.
The really interesting thing about the way that Anant Pai and his team decided to tell these classical Hindu mythological stories in the comic book format is that they've really sort of changed their approach to storytelling in the years that they've been making this comic book series. So with the very first issue, which is Krishna, Anant Pai, who has his own educational background in science, he really had some questions about whether or not the miracles in particular that are part of Hindu mythology were true. And he decided in telling the story of Krishna to eliminate those miracles, to not show Krishna lifting the Govardhan Mountain on his one finger, to not show the Yamuna River waters parting when his father carried him across when he was just a baby, so that modern readers could accept the story and not think about miracles as they were reading through it. And the interesting thing is that he got a lot of feedback from artists that he worked with in the series, from later story writers that he hired, and especially from readers who loved the idea of having an Indian comic book series but couldn't understand why these miracles had been eliminated. And eventually he had a bit of an epiphany, if you will, and he decided that these miracles were central to the stories and that one wasn't telling the stories properly if one eliminated the miracles. And so he created a revised edition of the Krishna comic book. And that's the version that you find that's reprinted again and again and again today.
The comic book series, The 99, doesn't translate Quranic text for its storyline. But there is an historic tale at the comic's foundation. So how has that been adapted? Creator Naif Al-Matawa.
The story of The 99 takes place in 13th century Baghdad as a backstory. So I started doing this in 2003 and Baghdad had just fallen for the umpteenth time. But there's a famous story that in 1258, when the Mongols invaded Baghdad, the library called Dar al-Hikmah, which is the most famous library in this day, was sacked and all those books were thrown into the Tigris River. And the Tigris changes color with the ink, the amount of ink in it. I rewrote that story. In my version, the librarians find out that there's a way to save all that information through using an alchemical solution. But when the Mongols got there, they threw the books and the solution into the Tigris. And librarians were able to save all that info by putting in 99 stones into the Tigris and sucking up all that information that we think is lost to humanity. Because those books were not just Muslim books, they were Muslim books and Jewish books and Christian books and Buddhist books. Because the caliph at the time had told his advisors, bring me any book you can get your hands on and translate it into Arabic and I'll give you its weight in gold. In other words, it was a time for openness of exchange of ideas and philosophies and ways of life. And so in my version of history, that information never left the Islamic world. That in fact, it's there for the whole world. And the storylines, you know, nobody's religion's ever talked about. The characters are from 99 different countries, from the West and the East and the North and the South. They're from different skin colors, the different genders. And what determines heroism is contextual, so not each character is able to solve all problems. It depends on the kind of problem and what their actual attribute is.
And one of the characters is a burqa-clad woman?
It's Batina, the hidden. So one of the 99 attributes of Allah is al-Batin, which means the hidden. So Batina is hidden. She hides behind her burqa, but she's also able to hide the 99 in times in which they need to be invisible. But she's a superhero. She's strong, she's silent, and I actually models her after my wife. So I actually even named the character, her Clark Kent name is Rulla, like my wife. And for me, like if I'm asked, do I believe that wearing the burqa is a part of Islam, I would wholeheartedly say no. It's a Bedouin tradition, has nothing to do with religion. However, at least 1% of the people in this world believe that it has something to do with them. And I wanted the 99 to be an inclusive, non-exclusive group of people. And so it was only fair that 1/99th of the characters wear a burqa.
You're listening to An Encounter that's looking at comics around the world that have religious foundations.
To the Batmobile. Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
Roger. Ready to move out.
Another important Christian archetypal story is Batman, according to Michael Brewer. He's the author of Who Needs a Superhero? And he's the pastor at the Blue Ash Presbyterian Church in Cincinnati.
At the other end of the spectrum from Superman, with his great powers and his unparalleled invincibility, at the other end of that is Batman, who is, physically at least, an ordinary human being, but he is a human being who has driven himself to be the best that a human being can be. So that, in a sense, Batman becomes the pinnacle of human development. But the thing that drives him is a deep-seated grief and a guilt that he cannot finally escape. Bruce Wayne, Batman, as a child, watched his parents be gunned down in an alley after having gone to the theater together. Both of his parents die, the thief runs off, and he devotes the rest of his life to trying to protect people like his parents. And he does a superb job. But the problem is, no matter how hard Batman tries, there are still other criminals out there. There are still other murders that he didn't get to in time. And so the helpless child who felt guilty to live as his parents died still lives in Batman. Batman is the epitome of the person driven to make the world right, who is invariably going to fall short. In the dictionary of Batman, there is no such word as grace. As a pastor, I see people like Batman in my congregation continually, and I think most pastors would agree with this. There are folks who work so hard to be good, folks who will undertake anything that needs doing, and on some level, frankly, they are a joy, because those are the folks you can always turn to, and you know they'll take on the job. But on some deeper level, as a pastor, it seems to me there's something unhealthy going on there. It seems that those folks are really trying to earn their way into God's good graces. And the problem with that path, for Batman or for the perennial volunteer, is that one can never be sure one has done enough. Any discussion of good works like this brings to mind the so-called rich young ruler who encounters Jesus in the Synoptic Gospels. You can find the story in Matthew. He comes to Jesus and says, Teacher, what must I do to be saved? And Jesus says, well, you know the law. And the man, with some presumption, says, well, I've kept all the laws since I was a young man. What more must I do? And Jesus says to him, you must sell everything you have and give it away to the poor and come follow me. And the man turns away with a heavy heart, unable to do this. The interesting thing about this story is, there's nothing to make us think that this was a general request from Jesus. He didn't demand that other people give up their worldly goods. In this case, he seems to have done it because he sees the chink in this man's armor. This man really is so dependent upon his own goodness and his wealth, which allows him to do good, that he cannot give up those props and rely on God alone. And so he turns away and leaves, unable to accept what Jesus is offering.
So is revelation of the divine lost when a sacred text is interpreted and married to images in the comic book form? Dr. Carlene McLean is the author of India's Immortal Comic Books and Assistant Professor of Religion at Bucknell University in Pennsylvania.
For a number of Hindus, the concept of darshan is central to Hindu religious practice. This is the idea of auspicious vision, that is, seeing the deity and being seen by that deity. And many Hindus believe that God can be found in any number of visual images. The image that might be housed at the very center of a Hindu temple, or a cheap lithograph image of that god that one might buy in a market and install in one's home altar. And I found this to be the case with comic books as well, that for some devout Hindus, they are a place where one can see and be seen by God. And so in that case, when you're done reading a comic book, you can't just throw it out or recycle it. It's important to keep it and to honor it and to preserve it. One reader I recall stated that these comic books radiate a spiritual force, which is really strong language.
The drawings of the gods, though, didn't have their eyes focused on the reader, did they? So why was that?
Particularly the cover images. Anant Pai was very insistent with the artists who made these cover images that God needed to look away, off to the left or to the right a little bit. And that was intentionally done so that this darshanic gaze would not naturally take place. Anumpai was very aware that in making these comic books, they weren't following a number of the ritual conventions that ideally should be followed when one is creating an image of God for worship. And so he didn't want to anger or to upset any Orthodox Hindus.
Comics always have a villain, so who are they in these Hindu comics?
In the Hindu mythological comic books featuring the gods like Rama and Krishna, the goddess Durga, there are always the demons, these forces of adharma, of chaos, of disorder in society. And so the formula that was established with these comics is a god figure here on earth, incarnate on earth, who comes to restore order, to restore dharma, and to do so engages in this fantastic epic battle with these demonic forces, and in the end of the comic book defeats them and restores order. In the comic books that feature historical figures, you have this same formula being applied. And so with the medieval figures, you have a historical Hindu king battling a Mughal emperor, battling a Muslim enemy. Some of the criticism that he received in the 1970s was from a number of Indian Muslims and others as well who were disturbed that Muslims had only been featured as villains and were wondering what this meant for the status of Muslims in India. Did they have a place in Indian history outside of being a villain? So Anant Pai and his team decided to institute a series of issues on the Mughal emperors. They put out a number of issues like Akbar, Shah Jahan, some other issues to feature these different Muslim rulers as heroes.
99 youngsters begin to discover the stones around the world. But who will guide the 99? The forces of light or the forces of darkness? Led by the sinister Rugal.
Our main villain is Rugal. Rugal was named after Abu Rugal, who was the person who gave King Abraha of Ethiopia directions to the Kaaba, which is the holiest site of Islam, during what's called the Year of the Elephant, the year the Prophet, peace be upon him, was born. And according to the Quran, God stopped the elephant army of Abraha by sending birds from the heavens that had stones, and those stones hit the elephants and stopped them dead in their tracks. So if we go back to the 99, the main bad guy is, what's his name? His name is Rugal, like Abu Rugal. And how is he stopped? He's stopped by the 99 using stones. So he basically wants to use the 99 for his own agenda. He manipulates them into believing he's the good guy. And it's the idea of kind of religion being used for good or for bad.
Superman has always been a fighter. In his earliest days, most of Superman's foes tended to be corrupt politicians and crooked cops and people who bullied the weak and oppressed people who could not protect themselves. Eventually, his primary foe became a character named Lex Luthor. Luthor is a scientist. He is a business magnate. He is a powerful figure who resents the fact that this alien has come into the world and caused us to look elsewhere for our salvation. In a sense, Luther, theologically speaking, is a person who believes that we ought to be able to save ourselves without any outside help. I don't know how villainous that makes him in the eyes of the world, but in Christian theology, it certainly makes him misguided. It puts him on the side of the Pharisees and those folks that Jesus encountered who seem to think that by their own good deeds and their own efforts, they could save themselves and set themselves right with God. So Superman does battle, in a sense, with those powers that convince us that we can become gods in our own right.
How do you draw villains?
When I draw villains in my cartoons, I'm going to draw a villain here. For those of you who can't see, it's probably sort of a very rough representation of me, because ultimately in the Bible stories we find that it's not about pointing the finger going, you're the villain, even though there are those characters in Bible stories, but realising that, watch out, because you could be a Pharisee or you could be a hypocrite yourself.
Christian cartoonist Phil Watson. So what's the future for the comics we've peeked into today? And what new plans do their creators have? Co-creator of the comic Torah, Aaron Freeman.
We're going to Iran, and we're going to do a comic about that.
What's that going to be based on?
Judaism was created by Iranians. The first person called a Jew was Mordechai in the Book of Esther. We're going to go visit the tombs of Mordechai and Esther. We're going to check out Isfahan, the great Jewish city. There are 6 active synagogues in Tehran. We look forward to spending Shabbat services in Tehran. And we're going to tell the story in pictures.
The comic book series Amar Chitrakata was produced by India Book House. It was bought a number of years ago by a new startup media, ACK Media. They've been working very rapidly on digitizing all of the comic books. They're now available on your cell phone or your mobile in India. So they're reaching out to a whole new generation of readers within India who are very tech savvy, and also to all of the South Asian diaspora that lives around the world today. And so the comic books can even have a much larger prominence in the lives of Hindus or of Indians more generally living in the diaspora than of those living within India. They can be one of the really formative sources that tell children throughout the diaspora what it means to be Hindu, what it means to be Indian.
We created a series of 26 episodes of animation with Endemol, who are the leading independent TV producer in the world. And our animated series has been picked up by a major U.S. broadcaster, and will be in tens of millions of U.S. households this fall. But also equally as exciting, you know, to commemorate President Obama reaching out to the Muslim world, Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman will be reaching out to the 99 to work together in a global series published this year by DC Comics.
Recently at a business summit held in Washington, President Obama commended the 99 and its creator, Dr. Naif Al-Matwa, for capturing the imaginations of young people through the message of tolerance. Dr. Michael Brewer.
The upcoming series that will bring the Justice League, that is Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, and others, together with a group of Islamic superheroes called the 99. I'd like to say that's groundbreaking stuff in comic books, but frankly, it's not. Comic book characters have always been pretty good at crossing lines of religion and ideology and acknowledging differences and working together in spite of those differences. I'd have to say comic books are a lot more enlightened in that regard than the real world. I wish we could take some cues from those costumed heroes.
That brings us to the end of this superhero edition of Encounter. My thanks to all the comic book creators and fans who shared their passion. If you want more adventures and you're in Kuwait, you can now go to a theme park designed around the characters and stories of the 99. And if you go to our website, you can find a comic book version of this program created by Phil Watson. That's at abc.net.au/rn/encounter. We'd love to hear your comments. So while you're on the transcript page, leave your thoughts. Technical production today was by Phil McKellar. I'm Kerry Stewart, and it's been good to have your company.
Temperance, it means sobriety, abstinence, moderation.
Well, I suppose I was rather like the doctor asked the bloke, do you drink anything? And the man said, yes, I'd drink anything virtually.
If you think the virtue of temperance is passé, imagine living without it.
I was tremendously out of control, caused other people and myself a great deal of trouble, stole cars, drove them off bridges. I'm extremely lucky to be alive.
For those who succumb to addiction, living a long and happy life isn't possible without the help of the experts, like advocate of Alcoholics Anonymous Ross Fitzgerald, sex addiction counsellor Heidi McConkie, and Buddhist scholar Bob Thurman, who's coming to Australia to talk about the middle path as the road to happiness.
I have a little bit of a wildness about me that I still haven't fully conquered, and therefore I still suffer.
You can hear all of them on Temperance, the second of the 7 Vital Virtues series on the Spirit of Things. Have a listen at the RN website.